Welcome once again to a special edition of the NutGallery.com podcast. Today we're interviewing Thomas Nagoski. I believe that's how you pronounce his name. I guess we'll find out a little bit later when we actually call him on the phone. I'm Shooter. With me is Mr. Jason James. And somehow he wrote me into this, as I'm not a huge comic book fan. And I really don't know what I'm doing for this interview. So you might see that while we go through this. Well, probably the same way he roped me into watching Captain Kronos Vampire Hunter.
Well, originally, Browncoat was supposed to be here in studio with me to do this interview, and he ended up having to work, and schedules didn't work out. So then I had to pull Shooter in just so there was a little more than just my voice doing the interview. So we'll have to live with Shooter's non-comic book interview.
Yeah, and you know, for once, instead of Browncoat, I'm going to be one that doesn't know what's going on.
All right, so I hope you enjoy our interview of Thomas Nagoski.
All right, now we got him on the phone, Mr. Thomas Nagoski.
There you go.
Just to get this interview started and get this first question out of the way.
Right.
What is your fear that snow monkeys are taking over the world?
Oh, geez. The snow monkeys thing comes from... It goes really far back to a cover of a Life magazine that I used to think was the greatest thing as when I was a little kid. There was this Life magazine that had this Japanese monkey sitting in like this frozen water. These monkeys that live in like the mountains of Japan, I guess, in the snow and stuff. And I always loved those monkeys and would always talk about them, you know, to various people about these like white monkeys in the snow and how cool that was. And then later on, as the years went on, when I worked at a college, I worked at a college, and I worked with monkeys. So I developed this like fascination with monkeys, and the snow monkey thing just kind of went along with it. Matter of fact, if you look at a lot of the stuff that I've written, you'll find a mention of a monkey at least once. in my books, in my comics, yeah, it's kind of odd. Matter of fact, one of my best monkey things was when Jeff Smith asked me to write the prequel to Bone. I had a monkey character named Mr. Pip. That was like a focal, like a main character in the story. So that was like I finally get to write a real monkey, you know.
There's I don't know if you were aware of the comedian named Tim Bador.
Okay.
And he has this big theory on the animal conspiracy, on how these animals are going to take over the world. So maybe you get together with him sometime. You can do a little
maybe, yeah. Maybe we can compare notes. but a lot of the stuff came from, you know, when I worked at the animal facility at the college and stuff. It was just fascinating. These monkeys were insane. You never knew what they were going to be doing. They were getting out of their cages and trying to let the other monkeys out. And it got kind of scary. You never knew what you were going to stumble across when you came in the morning to like feed them or clean their cages or something. You'd walk in a room and there'd be one of them out looking at you, flipping the lock. You know, to let another one out. You know, like, oh my God! You'd run, get out of there as quick as you can and call security, you know?
You have a book due out in July, I think, called Billy Hooten, Owl Boy?
Yeah, Billy Hooten, Owl Boy comes out, actually the first two Billy Hooten books come out in July. I think it's like July 26th is like the official release date. But yeah, they're two kids' books that I did with Eric Powell of The Goon. Did the designs and the illustrations for the books. They're pretty amazing. The artwork is just phenomenal.
What's the basis on the books?
The book's about a kind of a 12-year-old kid, kind of a geeky 12-year-old kid who loves books and anything kind of disturbing and weird, who discovers that there's a city beneath the cemetery next door to his house. It's like a city of monsters underneath the cemetery, and that there is a superhero that protects the city, but called Owlboy. But the particular Owlboy has been missing for a certain amount of years, and Billy discovers that he's the next in line to become Owlboy to protect this city of monsters. So it's pretty outrageous. It was a blast to write. It's what's quirky about it is that, you know, here's this bizarre kid who has, you know, always been in his garage, you know, designing jetpacks and robots and stuff that never work, of course. But if he brings the stuff to Monster City, which is the name of the Monster City underneath the cemetery, the laws of physics don't work the same. So he can make a jetpack out of a fire extinguisher or a giant robot out of, you know, cardboard boxes and some pieces he found from a refrigerator motor or something like that. It's like this world where anything goes, you know? So he's a 12-year-old kid in this makeshift superhero costume who actually gets to be a real superhero in this world.
If there was any recreational drugs used in the writing of this...
There was actually scotch. Scotch was my friend during the writing of this book. But actually, you know, it's one of those things where the idea originally started as a comic book, just like a comic book idea, because I didn't think that there were enough, like, all ages comics out there, you know, because I was reading Bone and you know, there was Mike Kunkel's Hero Bear and the Kid and stuff like that, and I was really enjoying those comics a lot, and I was like, man, there's like three of them out there, and you know, the entire comic book and, you know, industry, there's only three comics that, you know, everybody could read and enjoy. So Billy Hooten started as that, and just couldn't get it off the ground, no matter, you know, who I'd hook up with artists and things like that, and we'd be all excited about it and ready to go apart, and we wouldn't even bother. We just I'd get tossed aside because I'd get busy, the artist would get busy. And then finally, when I started to do a lot more book stuff, I was like, maybe this could work as an all ages, you know, book title, like a young reader's book title. And eventually found an editor who understood the insanity of the material immediately. And that's how it happened. So I've written two that come out in July, and I've just been I just got contracts to write two more.
Well, good luck with those.
Yeah, there'll be four Billy Hootens, I could probably do more if these sell well. I could probably come up with at least four more because they're really crazy and fun, and so I don't really have to kill myself to write them. That's for sure.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah,
just really enjoyable. Really enjoyable. I just kind of think back to, you know, the crazy things that I did as a kid, and then I just kind of put a spin on them involving monsters and stuff like that, and there you go. A novel. There you go.
I suppose it's always better when you enjoy what you write. It probably comes a lot easier then.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Especially when you have, like, that, affinity to the material, you know. And then you throw Eric Powell into the mix, and, you know, it just soars at that point. It's just sweet.
Well, I was going to go back and talk about some of the stuff you've worked on in the past.
Sure.
You worked with on the Buffy and Angel comics. What's it like to work in that universe?
That was really cool because what was cool about the Buffy universe is the fact that I was a huge fan of the show. You know, when the show first started, you could just tell that there was something really unique going on here. You know, it was like, wow, this stuff is sweet. It was Chris Gold on almost all the the media tie-in stuff with that. He did the very first Buffy novel that, you know, as a result of the TV series. So when he did the novel, he became kind of like the go-to guy for Buffy and media stuff. So Dark Horse immediately hooked up with him not too soon after, like the very, I think they did some issues of the comic with Andy Watson was the first guy to do the Buffy comic. And I'm not sure if Chris did Buffy after Andy, but I think he did some Buffy after, and then he did Angel. So, you know, with him involved, you know, we're really good friends and stuff and do a lot of writing together, so it was only a matter of time before I got pulled into the Buffyverse as well. But yeah, that stuff was a lot of fun. That stuff was really cool.
Excellent. Now, were you also involved in the video game, the Buffy video game?
Yep, we did both of them. Yeah, we did both of them. The first one, which was only, they had already come up with the game, in the story of the game. So what we had to do was kind of go in and do all, you know, tweak all the dialogue and make it sound like the Buffy characters. Yeah, because they kept getting swatted down by Joss's people. They were like, "No, that doesn't sound right. They don't know. They don't say it that way. No, they wouldn't. No, that doesn't work." So one of the people in high up in Joss's office said, "Look, we got these guys. They can go in. They can, you know, fix your dialogue, add your dialogue, and give it the real Buffy sound that you want." So that's how we got involved with that. And then with the second one, we actually came up with the plot and everything for, we had a lot more to do with the actual planning and everything of the second game. Even though the gameplay isn't as good, I guess, from with the, I'm not really a gaming guy, but from what everybody kind of complains that the mechanics of the game aren't as great, but the story is good. So, whatever.
I've actually been playing the first one, and I really do like the gameplay and the story, and I really thought the characters did sound like they were supposed to sound like, so you guys did a good job.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really pleased with, you know, it's amazing how, you know, you want to tear your eyes out after a while because you just have to write, like, hundreds and hundreds of pieces of dialogue for Vampire Number 3. You know what I mean? Because when he dies or he falls or he gets kicked or punched or something like that, he has to say something different every time. So literally we were writing hundreds of dialogue for a character that was probably going to get dusted, you know, by most people, you know, as soon as they started to fight the character or play the or come up against the character. But you needed to have all the pieces of dialogue, you know, so when a person played the game again, it wouldn't be the same thing over and over again. So that would make you I mean, I'd get calls from Chris at like 10 o'clock at night saying, "I'm going to kill myself. You have to finish Vampire Number 12. I can't do anymore. I can't come up. I can't. My brain is done. We're done."
Now, did you, kind of along the same lines of the stuff that you've done, have done previously, is there anything out there that's a little bit less well known that people might not normally think of you as being involved with it that you've worked on that?
Let me think. Like comic book wise and stuff.
Well, comic book thing wise, I mean something that that you're real proud of that you did that that other people might not know that you had a hand in.
Let me think. I mean, when I first started out in comics, I did a lot of, like, black and white, like, independent stuff that was a blast. I mean, I still look on, look on that stuff, like, really fondly, because it gave me the chops, you know, to pursue comics and pursue, like, writing as a profession and stuff like that. So, like, the Caliber Press or Caliber Comics, I did a bunch of stuff for them. I actually did a series of mini with Sword of Sharpei, and basically it was about my dog. I had a Chinese Sharpei. Those are those wrinkly dogs.
Okay.
You know, the dogs with the real wrinkled skin. I did this kind of crazy, almost like Lone Wolf and Cub meets Jack Kirby's Commandy, you know, with these genetically engineered animals, you know, in this almost like feudal Japan type world and stuff. And I did Swords of Sharpei, and then I did Guns of Sharpei. And then, like, a couple of years later, when I was doing some work at Crusade with Billy Tucci, you know, the guy that does She, I did a book called, he started to publish some little black and white titles, and I did a book called Dogs of War, which was the next phase of those characters and stuff like that. And those were a blast. I mean, I think nobody knows I did those because nobody can find them. They probably had print runs of like 10,000 copies or less, you know what I mean? But those were a real blast to do. I really I think back on those days and remember those days of not making any money.
I know a lot of times, you know, especially for artists that there might be something in particular like that they're very proud of that people might not know about or that nobody thinks of them as being involved with.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I did Vampirella for years. I wrote Vampirella for Harris Comics from I did Vampirella from like 2000 and or even I think I started it in actually in the 90s. Now that I'm getting so old now, I don't even remember. I did Vampirella for like 3 or 4 years.
Well, you're kind of part of a rebirth of that.
Yeah, actually, I was part of the rebirth. When they first brought it back, they brought it back as a black and white book, and it was distributed at Dark Horse, but it was still a Harris production, but it was distributed through Dark Horse, and Kurt Busiek was the writer. And then they brought it, Harris decided that they were going to distribute it themselves and started to do, and Busick was the writer on that for, I believe, the first, maybe like the, I think it was the first two issues. And then I got brought in on like issue three and was the regular writer on that until it became Vengeance of Vampirella and they started it over again with a new number one. And I was on Vengeance and right until the end.
Right.
And then they spun out and did some miniseries and stuff like that. And I did some of the miniseries, but that was pretty much my tenure on Vampirella was after Vengeance. I did a couple of miniseries and that was about it.
You also got to put your own spin on the Star Trek universe in your graphic novel.
Yeah.
Also.
Yeah, that was fun. That was that kind of came out of left field. That was one of those things where Chris and I knew Jeff Marriott, who was working at Wildstorm at the time, and Wildstorm got the Star Trek license. And Jeff approached Clowns, had any interest in Star Trek, and Chris and I both favorite episode was Wolf in the Fold, which was the one about the Scotty's accused of murdering this girl on a planet, and you find out it's like the spirit of Jack the Ripper is like this cosmic entity that floats through the universe, like possessing people.
Yep.
So, yeah, so it was like Star Trek with a horror spin, which is just like right up Chris and I's alley. So what we did was we decided to, you know, to say that that entity was still alive and to stick it in the holodeck on the Enterprise. So you have Data, you know, as Sherlock Holmes, you know, because the entity causes the holodeck to become like London, you know. So it was really, that was a blast. We had a really good time with that.
Yeah, I enjoyed that book.
Actually, I got it right in front of me right now. Now, I actually read through this one, even though I don't read too many comics.
Right.
And I was kind of wondering now, how do you guys go about deciding who writes who, or do you kind of pick characters and the one guy writes one character and somebody else writes a character? Or...
Well, it's funny because Chris and I, when Chris and I work with each other, like, if, for example, if we were doing a novel, our novel, the way we did it, we'd do a novel together would be completely different than the way we do a comic book together. Well, how we would do a comic book usually is one of us would, like, roughly plot it out, and then the other guy would go in and kind of break it down panel-wise, you know, as in terms of, you know, page one, panel one, kind of describe what's going on, because I'm usually a little bit better at that than he is, so... and relatively faster at it, so I would do that. And then what we would do is we would get together. It would be like, you know, Chris and Tom Day at Chris's house, where I would get there like bright and early in the morning, and we would just script. We would sit and just basically throw out dialogue for the rest of the day and wrap it up usually at around supper time, and then I'd have supper over there, and then I'd be home by 10, you know? Do our comic stuff. Is we actually sit side by side, his hands on the keyboard, and we just throw out the dialogue. You know, we read the description of the scene and just bang out the dialogue until we get the best, you know, the best fit for the particular panel, and then we go from there.
Now, is it easier or harder to write on, based on characters that have already been on a TV show or something like that, characters that have already been developed, or is it easier to make your own stuff?
I think it's tougher to write established characters because they are established. They have a, you know, especially something like Buffy, there is a very specific rhythm to the way these characters talk. You know, Joss and Joss's people who wrote the, you know, the scripts and stuff, there's a real identity to the dialogue and the way the dialogue is spoken with those characters. So you had a really, you know, you found yourself reading this stuff out loud a lot, just to make sure it sounded right and it had the right rhythm. I wrote an Angel novel. Matter of fact, that was my first novel that I wrote for Simon & Schuster. And I was, like, having fits because in the book, my Angel book, had the character of Doyle. And Doyle was a half-breed. He was half-human, half-demon. But he had an Irish brogue, a very faint Irish brogue. So you had to, you know, to capture the Doyle character, you had to make sure that when people were reading this dialogue, they were hearing that lilt. They were hearing that, you know, that very specific rhythm to his voice, because he had a very specific way of speaking. And the same goes for like Willow and Tara and stuff like that. They all had very specific rhythms to their voice. So, yeah, actually, it's a lot easier to write your own characters because, you know, when you think of your own characters, you kind of, I think they're kind of almost a piece of you already, so you have a sense of how they hear because they kind of came out of you to get their speech patterns correct, you know, relatively early on, whereas when you have to duplicate somebody else's style and make sure that you know, that you're capturing that voice. Another character like that is Hellboy. Mike has a very distinct style of writing that character's voice, and if you don't get it, it doesn't work.
I can see this. Now, as the way I understand this, you guys kind of write it first, right? And then later on, the storyboard artists and the guys come in and write and actually draw the stuff in, right?
Yeah. I mean, all depending on how you do it. I mean, some artists prefer not to work from a full script. Some artists like to have, like, just like a general outline as to what the comic's going to be. And then when the artwork is done, the writer will go in and kind of, like, lay the dialogue and stuff in from there that way. If I had my druthers, I would always work full script and then adjust things accordingly from there if the artist isn't happy with something. But I don't know, working with just, you know, having artwork plopped down in front of you and having someone say, okay, what are they saying? I don't know. There's just something about that kind of freaks me out. I mean, maybe it's like a lack of control because, you know, I didn't picture it looking that way. You know, what would they say? I prefer full script as opposed to, it's actually called Marvel style when the artist works from an outline and then the writers go in and do the actual script from the artwork. That's Marvel style.
That's good, because I was actually driving at a point with that question, now I see that. So you are actually in control of making sure that there's plenty of well-drawn, scantily clad women in the comic book.
If it calls, I am in control. Well, that's how it was with Vampirella. They were very, very specific about what the type of book Vampirella was, even though I didn't want it to be that kind of book, really. They would always say, you know, why is she in a jacket? Take that jacket off! I was like, yeah, but a jacket looks cool, and she got no, she must not have a jacket.
Well, I specifically enjoyed the Beverly Crusher character in this one when she was possessed by Red Jack, because he was just way more saucy. I liked it.
It's saucy. That we probably owe the sauciness. I don't even remember us saying that she was sexy, you know, especially Beverly Crusher. You know, I'm not quite sure we would have gone that far. It's probably the artist that just wanted to.
Well, yeah, they sure made him look good in this one. That's all I can.
You've worked quite a bit with Christopher Golden. How did that team up come about?
We met. I'm trying to think. I think we met at a horror convention. And we met at a I think it was a World Horror Con in Connecticut, and just really just had a lot of things in common and just really kind of hit it off. And at the same time, he had been talking to Harris Comics as well about possibly doing some stuff. So, I mean, we kind of shared the Harris Comics thing, and also he hadn't broken into comics yet and had always wanted to do more comics, and I had always wanted to do books. So we almost kind of like helped each other. We almost kind of like traded off, you know. He kind of gave me the ins and out of the book biz, and I kind of gave him the ins and out of the comic biz, and then we started to do actually both of those things together. So, you know, it's like a meeting of minds, of like minds. You know, it actually comes to a point now where the stuff that we work on together, I can't even tell you who's done what.
Wow.
And people say, oh, who wrote that scene? And this one was when he said to me, oh, I love that. That scene was awesome. And I'm like, yeah, I didn't write it. And he's like, well, no, what do you mean? No, you wrote that scene. And I'm like, no, Chris, I didn't write that scene. So we don't even know. What? You know, when by the time that project is done, you know, and polished and put away. We can tell some of the stuff because of our quirks. If there's a monkey, you know, I probably did it. but a lot of the times we really can't tell who did what. because we kind of forget. It kind of just merges together.
Now, your novel, The Fallen, was turned into an ABC miniseries.
Yes, yes. Actually, last year, the first 2 hours premiered, I believe, in July. It actually premiered the night of San Diego Comic-Con, the last night of Comic-Con.
I did catch it. So it.
You did? Yeah, I thought they did a pretty. I was really kind of happy with it. My books are a little nastier, a little harsher. But all in all, I've seen a lot worse in regards to adaptations. The next 4 hours of that airs on August 3rd, 4th, and 5th on ABC Family this August. So we'll get to see some more. The next hours don't follow the books all that closely. I think they kind of did their own thing as Hollywood is wont to do. But I don't care. I think they did a terrific job at the first one. So I'm willing to cut them some slack unless it's horrible. I haven't seen it yet. They keep promising to send me a DVD of the next 4 hours, but no one has done it yet. So they probably, we don't want Tom pissed. We won't send it. We'll just say we forgot.
The two hours we've already seen, did that cover like just one book or?
Yeah, the first 2 hours was pretty much the first book.
Okay.
And there's a total of four books, so there's three more books, but they kind of, like I said, they take some elements from the next three books, but they really didn't follow any of the plots all that closely from the next three books. They kind of did their own thing.
Now, when I download that from iTunes, do you get royalties on that?
No, I don't. Oh. But I should. You owe me you owe me $5.
I think I only paid $6 for the two episodes, actually.
Oh, that's okay. All right. Well, I'll figure out how much you owe me, and I'll get back to you.
All right. I also read the Wolverine and the Punisher series Revelation.
Oh, okay.
Both of those would appear on my top 10 list of superheroes. So. I was kind of glad to see them together.
Yeah, that was an interesting thing because it was kind of we had done the first Marvel Knights Punisher, which had that supernatural spin to it that we did with Bernie Wrightson, and this was pretty much a sequel to that. But then Marvel was like, throw in Wolverine, and then a little while later it was throw in things that are biomechanical. Throw in underground cities. You know, they were basically they got Pat Lee to agree to draw the miniseries, and they were just trying to keep Pat Lee happy. So Pat Lee would say, "Oh, I like drawing, you know, fish with wings." They would have been throwing at us, and make sure it's got fish with wings in it. Every day we were getting a new email or a new phone call from the editor on the book telling us, "Oh yeah, make sure it has this in it, and make sure it has three girls." So
he left out monkeys.
I think that was like one of the very few comics at that time that I couldn't find a way to squeeze a monkey in.
Maybe you'll get to do a Wizard of Oz comic book or something sometime, and you can have the flying monkeys.
There were some comparisons or similarities between the Punisher and your Fallen character. Is that just coincidence or?
I think there's just an angel fixation, which I've had like for along with my monkey fixation. I've had like this angel thing that I've been dying to use for so long that, you know, you can see it trickling into that Punisher miniseries. You can see it trickling into one of the story arcs that I did in Vampirella. You can see it trickling into some of like the black and white independent stuff that I did, but it never went the whole road. And when I finally was given the opportunity to write The Fallen, you know, to do that series of books, I mean, that was like all this bizarre research and stuff that I had done finally found a home, you know, all of it, and I got to use the whole shebang, you know, I got to use all of it. You know, all the stuff that I've been reading about for, you know, in my Catholic upbringing, for years and years and years, finally found a way out.
On the same lines, are you a fan of the movie Dogma, then?
Dogma's really fun. I thought Dogma was great. I thought Dogma was a great movie. That's actually I think that's my favorite of the Kevin Smith stuff. I think, because that one had a really, I thought the script was really good.
That's on my top 10 list right there. That one definitely.
Oh really?
Yep.
Is there one character you would like to work on, or one universe you'd like to work in for comic
books? Oh geez. You know, it's funny. There was a project that I would have said was my dream project that I actually got to write about a year and a half ago. Eric Powell and I did Devil Dinosaur for Marvel. And that had always been one of my all-time favorite characters. And one day, out of the blue, Eric calls me. It's like a Saturday morning. I never hear him. I talked to him during the week. So I thought something was wrong. I'm like, what's wrong? And he's like, an editor at Marvel called me, and he asked me if I wanted to do Devil Dinosaur. And I was like, oh, my God, you can't be serious. And he's like, yeah, do you want to do it with me? And I was like, holy God. It's like my prayers have been answered, you know? So... Yeah, so we got to do, and that was an absolute blast. Have either of you guys seen that?
No, I haven't.
Oh my God, are you familiar with his artwork? Eric's artwork, the guy that does the Goon.
Not a whole lot, no.
Okay, he is like this throwback to like Kirby,
okay.
And he did the most amazing Devil Dinosaur that I just was like floored by how amazing this artwork was. It's just he really, really, really paid a tribute to Jack. I mean, I'm sure Jack was giving us the thumbs up from heaven, you know, because he really did an amazing job. And it was kind of quirky and fun, like Monkey Boy and a giant red dinosaur. It's like, you know, it's cavemen. You know, it's a story about cavemen. But we managed to get the Celestials from the Marvel Universe into the story and everything. And the Hulk was in the story. And it was just great. Because Eric draws this great Kirby-esque Hulk with the big square head and the big square hands and stuff like that. Yeah, that was a blast. I mean, I absolutely loved working on that. That was like one of my favorite comic projects that I've ever worked on. But if I had one thing that in terms of a character or characters that I could work on, I would love to write the Fantastic Four.
Hmm. If I had that power, I'd help you out. But
you mean you don't?
So have you always been a comic book fan yourself, or
always, always, right from little kid? I mean, I can remember, you know, going by like the smoke on my way to kindergarten, and in the window they'd have like the comics hanging on the clips, you know, they're hanging on almost like this clothesline in the window that had magazines, but there was a whole section of comic books, and I can like tell you the covers of the comics. I mean, they spoke to me even at an early age. I mean, yeah, huge comic book fan.
So what do you like writing more, comics or novels?
Oh God, novels rip your soul out. Novels drain you of your life force. Whereas comics are really fun. Comics, I mean, they can be difficult. They can be taxing and tiring and stuff like that. But there's always this kind of quirkiness that once you get on the ball with it, you just fly and you're just really into the whole fun aspect of it. So comics are more fun. Novels are rewarding and you know, you really feel like you've accomplished a lot once you have one finished. I think comics are more fun to work on because they're quicker, they're faster. I think you get quicker satisfaction. I mean, I can bang out a comic in a couple of days where it takes me about 3 or 4 months to write a book, you know?
Have you always enjoyed writing?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, always. I mean, I can remember sitting in front of an old typewriter when I was like in like third grade, and I just like typing these crazy Godzilla stories out of my head, you know, with no punctuation and stuff like that. But it was still an attempt, you know. It was, yeah, I was trying to tell a story, you know, a made up story even then. But you know, nobody could read the damn thing because there was no punctuation. Just kind of flowed into everything else. But I think I've always been interested in telling a story. I mean,
well, I'm sure it made sense to you.
Yeah, y'all perfectly. I saw it in my head, you know, before it even left my fingers into the typewriter. Yeah, always enjoy telling stories.
Did you read any books, or were there any authors that influenced you as a writer?
Well, it's interesting. Growing up, I had this conversation with somebody. Since I'm doing a lot of stuff for younger readers and stuff these days, I talk with my editors, and they were like, "Well, what did you read as a kid, Tom?" Well, I skipped like the children's writers of the time period, and I read like the Doc Savage books. I mean, here I am in like third and fourth grade, and I'm reading, you know, Brand of the Werewolf, Doc Savage, you know, or The Shadow. I mean, so even then, I was kind of like drawn to these kind of like quirky characters, you know. I mean, if you think about it, The Shadow and Doc Savage and the Avenger and things like that are like precursors to the superheroes, precursors to Batman and things like that. So, you know, that was my thing. I mean, I didn't read really any as a kid, and went right into those pulp books that Bantam did in the 60s, mid 60s they were doing them, into the 70s.
I can relate to that. I went right from C Spot Run to reading Stephen King's It.
When
I was like in fifth or sixth grade.
Yep. And it's what's interesting too is that I don't even know how much, in regards to me anyways, I don't even know how much of this I was getting. You know, I think the books were above me. I don't think I grasped a lot of what I was reading, but damn it, were those covers awesome. You know, that's what it was. Those covers were enough to just basically say to, you know, I gotta have that. Inside, underneath those covers has got to be the greatest thing in the world, and I'm going to force myself to figure out what the hell these guys are talking about, you know? But, yeah, the Doc, these amazing covers that just, like mesmerized me, you know? I just had to have them.
Yeah, it's like you read a couple words in there, and you're like, well, note to self, I got to find out what that word means. I remember saying
that. Yeah, I got to know what the hell they're talking about here.
Now, before we started the show, you mentioned some movie options for some of your
books. Yes.
What do you got going with that?
Well, as far as Chris and I did a comic book last year called Talent for Boom Studios, and that's been optioned by Universal just like last year, last summer, that was optioned by Universal. That's currently in the script stage, but they're all, supposedly all hot and bothered about it and raring to go once they get a completed script. Chris and I also wrote a series of fantasy books called Outcast, and that was optioned by Universal as well. And that was like, I think about a year and a half, that was originally optioned. And I have some books that I wrote, two books, Sleeper Code and The Sleeper Agenda. And those have both been optioned by Warner Brothers, and they're currently in the script stage. So, and there's also another project that I can't talk about yet.
Oh.
It hasn't been 100% officially announced, even though it's been optioned and a script is being written and they've hired a director. It's probably the closest out of all this stuff to a green light, but the studio doesn't want to say anything yet. But it's an original project that Chris and I created as a comic book, and then yanked it from the publisher that was going to do the comic book because we didn't care for how he was treating the project, and we sold it to Hollywood before it even found a home. Has found a home, and that's something else I can't talk about yet because they want to make an official announcement. But yeah, it's the comic will be seen. It's just a matter of time before the studio that got the option wants to announce the thing, but it's a pretty cool project that Chris and I came up with. So,
well, once you're allowed to release that, you'll have to let us know so we can.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That
yeah,
you can at least give us
a little.
You can't even give us a hint now. See, now I'm interested.
No, I really can't. I mean, it's an original property. It's kind of a action adventure horror story. That's about as much as I can say. But the guy that's been hired to direct it and stuff is a new, you know, up and coming guy who's only done like a couple of things, but he's really good. So I got my fingers crossed because he's the guy. He's actually scripting it. right now because he liked the project so much that he wanted to. He liked the comic book so much that he wanted to write the script. So that the script that he delivers is as good as he is. You know, after seeing his first film and stuff. So we're very excited to see what he turns in when he turns in the first draft of his script.
Yeah, well, that's definitely where I like to view my comic books is on the big screen. So I'm excited about these other things you're talking about. So now, just can you give us a quick like you mentioned talent?
Yeah.
Can you give us a quick just summary of what the plot or the basis behind?
Yeah, the plot of Talent is about a guy named Nicholas Gane, just kind of like this average everyday guy who's on this plane flight back from a job interview. When the plane explodes, basically crashing into the ocean, all on board are supposedly dead. And as the pulling up the wreckage of the plane from the bottom of the ocean, recovering the seats and stuff, they find him strapped into his seat still, and he's still alive. He's been underwater for over 12 hours. And he's still alive. So the main thrust of the story is who is Nicholas Gane and why did he survive? He doesn't think he's anybody any special. Nobody really can seem to dig up any information on him saying that he's anything but just an average guy that has a teaching degree who's looking for work. But what he discovers about himself is as he's recovering in the hospital room, of course he's under like security and everything like that because they think, he had something to do with the explosion that downed the plane. He discovers that there's almost like a secret, like covert agency up to no good, and was responsible for the blowing up of the plane. Who decide that he's kind of a loose end that they don't want hanging around, so they decide that they're going to eliminate him. And in the process of eliminating him, he discovers that somehow he's acquired all the talents of all the people that he died with, that died with him on the plane.
That's interesting. That sounds pretty cool.
So when, like, for example, at one point he's sitting in his hospital bed and he's doing origami. making a crane, and he has no idea where he got the ability to do that.
And he thinks back and realizes there was the token Japanese guy that was on the plane. So
it was actually a Japanese woman on the plane, yeah. So when he learns that he has these abilities, he actually learns from this almost like heavenly-type power that is telling him that he's been given this gift to help stop an evil that's, that was responsible for bringing out and it was really bad planned as well. But besides that, he has to clear up the loose ends of the people on the plane. So, for example, the woman that origami had this enormous fight with her husband before she got on the plane, and he just picks up the phone and knows the number and calls her husband and basically tells the husband that she loved him, and he loses the ability. So when it's like unfinished business. When the unfinished business is taken care of, he loses that talent.
Hmm.
Now, like when the creepy agency comes to eliminate him, he suddenly has the abilities of a prize fighter, and a prize fighter was with him on the plane. So he beats the crap out of the guy. He doesn't have any idea what he's doing at all, but he has all the skill and the instinct of a prize fighter, just clobbers this guy. But at that point he goes on the run, and he starts to utilize the talents of the people on board the plane to help solve the mystery of the people who took the plane down. But yeah, it's called Talent, and I think the collection, they're doing, Boom is doing a collection. I think it was solicited already in previews, so it's got to be coming out sometime this summer.
Well, we'll have to definitely watch for that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, the comics are out there. It was a four-issue miniseries, but the collection, I believe, is probably scheduled for like maybe like like August, maybe August, September, I think. I wish I remembered these things.
I'm a one of the bad comic book collectors. I like to buy things in trades and collections.
Yeah, so. You know what? Yeah, I can see it. That way you're getting the whole story in one sitting.
Right.
I mean, I still buy my monthly. I just that's just a habit that I don't think will ever go away.
I still get some monthly, but the bulk of them I buy collected.
Yeah.
So do you have any other future projects you want to talk about right now, or?
Let me see. I've got, like I said, two more Billy Hootons coming, and I've got a new series that I'm writing for Simon & Schuster called The Brimstone Network, which is three books in a series about this this kind of alternate history type world where the supernatural is like this common everyday. It's a threat. You know, the threat of the supernatural exists, and there's this agency called the Brimstone Network that exists to combat the forces of darkness before they can get out of hand. Well, in the course of this story, something really horrible happens to the network, where everybody is killed in the network, so the world is left defenseless. But the leader of the group, before he dies, sets in motion like a contingency plan that involves me, like 13 years old, who now has to gather up all these, you know, these new younger members with like special abilities to form a new Brimstone Network to fight, you know, this world-threatening evil. So it's like he has to kind of gather this team of like misfits. That all have like this is like a handicapped kid with these ridiculously powerful psychic abilities, and there's a 12-year-old girl who happens to be a werewolf, and he's being trained by this character named Mr. Stitch, and who come to find out Mr. Stitch is like almost like a Frankenstein monster, but he's made up of all the pieces of the best Brimstone Network agents that ever lived, that they've like basically saved and built the ultimate Brimstone Network agent out of these pieces. But he's like he's almost like the mentor. He's like the help guide these kids on the, you know, to become the new Brimstone Network and keep the world safe. But that should be a blast. That should be a lot of fun.
What's your target audience for that book?
That's actually I believe they call that middle grade, so that's like 9 to 13, you know, and basically I wrote it as, you know, what if I was 12 years old, what book would put me in a coma? What would get me so excited that I had to read it? And this was the book that this was the series that I came up with.
All right. We do a little thing at the end of, or near the end of all of our interviews so far, called Rapid Fire, and we just kind of give you a few questions kind of fast, and kind of just give us the first thing that comes to your mind when you.
Okay.
So if you're ready for that.
This could be dangerous.
I'm seeing that already. They're not too bad. I might have a couple of my own here though, and we got a couple written down here, but you never know.
Okay.
All right. Current or last book you've read?
Heart-Shaped Box by Joe Hill. Amazing book.
Okay, if you were only allowed to read one more book that you have not read yet, what would it be?
Oh, jeez. The thing I'm looking forward to reading right now is Blaze, which is the new book by Richard Bachman, who it's actually a Stephen King. It just came out. It came out Tuesday, and I'm ecstatic. I can't wait to read it.
Right. Who is the most influential person in your life?
Probably my dad. A close second to my dad, in far as influencing what I do, is probably Jack Kirby.
Cool.
They go kind of hand in hand, you know.
All right. One person that you would like to meet?
Actually, I would have loved to have met Jack Kirby. I would have loved to have met Jack Kirby.
That works. It can be passed.
Yeah.
All right. If you had unlimited power to change one thing in the world, what would it be?
I know I hate to sound like a cornball, but I'd love to get this war over with. I just love to see things kind of just calm down a little bit.
That's a good answer.
And I'm going to add my own on here. Kate Beckinsale or Mila Jovovich?
Kate Beckinsale.
Excellent.
Well, at the end, we'd like to open it up. Anything you want to talk about or let our audience hear, the floor is yours.
Oh, geez. Keep reading my stuff. I appreciate anybody who, stuff that I'm working on, the stuff that Chris and I are working on.
Especially the stuff that you actually get royalties from, right?
Yes. That's even better. That's even better. That's you always forget about the royalties. At least I do. And then when they show up in the mail, it's like a gift. A gift from the gods. It's like, oh, free money.
Oh, wait, that wasn't free.
No, not free at all. But it seems like it's free because you forgot all about it. But that's pretty much it. I'd just like to thank everybody for helping to support me in what I do.
Well, it's definitely been fun, and hopefully you enjoyed it also.
Yeah, that was a blast.
All right.
Well, it was good talking to you. And
all right, good talking to you too.
Good luck with your projects, and I can't wait to hear your movie deal when that gets released.
Oh, the secret project. Yeah, stay in touch. Definitely stay in touch. I'll be more than happy to talk about it as soon as they tell me that I can.
Okay, cool.